Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 171 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling the whys and wherefores of wheat prices. WSU economist Randy Fortenberry sets the scene. From a presentation Fortenberry gave during the Pacific Northwest Farm Forum held February 5th, 2020. I was planning to release another Falling Numbers podcast this week, but based on declining listenership numbers, I realized I may have miscalculated. Hence my moving Randy Fortenberry's remarks at Farm Forum to the front of the queue. Well, that and the fact I didn't want his presentation to spoil due to exposure to recent fast-moving events regarding the COVID-19 virus. Fortenberry talked about the coronavirus in his speech and suggested it could impact markets, but that was before social distancing in much of the U.S. was mandated. Which is why, in the process of producing this and next week's podcast, I contacted Fortenberry to ask whether his comments still held water, given all the changes that have occurred in the 8 weeks since he spoke at Farm Forum. Certainly, I don't want to provide bad information to listeners, and I half expected Fortenberry to ask me not to broadcast his presentation, thinking perhaps the fundamentals underlying the market might have changed. But fundamentals are called just that because they don't change a lot, not even when a viral pandemic is assaulting our world. There were a couple of items he noted that could upset the apple cart, or in wheat's case, the bankout wagon. One, he told me, is if the logistics of moving commodities between countries becomes impaired. That hasn't happened so far, and in fact, China has finally begun living up to its Phase 1 agreement to buy more U.S. commodities, including new crop wheat. But Fortenberry also told me over the phone that while new crop sales are on the books, they haven't been shipped, and there's no guarantee that they will be until they are. As you'll hear ahead, Fortenberry also talked about the value of the dollar, noting its strength is a hindrance to U.S. wheat exports. That's because the stronger the dollar becomes, the more expensive our wheat is to overseas buyers. And that dollar strength has only increased since he spoke. Or as he put it, the exchange rate is as strong as it has been in the last 3 years. That's because people seek safety in what is still essentially the world's safest currency. Although wheat farmers are a big part of the audience that Farm Forum caters to, it is not the only audience, and Fortenberry also talked about cattle and fruit. But I'm a weedy through and through, so you won't be hearing that portion. As always, I hope you check the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page for photos and slides from Fortenberry's presentation, and while you're there, please follow the page. Fortenberry began his comments by remarking on his attire, hoping that the somber black suit he wore didn't portend anything more than his clothing choice that morning.
I was talking to a few people earlier this morning. They were asking me about the way I'm dressed. I don't usually wear suits or anything. And I was telling them, you know, about 3 years ago, some family members were telling me, you need to get like a black suit. I'm like, I don't need a black suit. I don't wear them. But they kept pushing me and pushing me. So finally I gave in. And I don't want you to infer anything from this. This is the fourth time I've worn it, and the first three times were funerals. So I hope today goes better than the last three times. And I don't intend this to be a funeral. There are some optimistic things we can talk about. There's some challenges that we face. So we'll try to cover both those. What I'm going to do this morning is give you a really broad picture of kind of where the U.S. ag sector sits. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the trade environment, because a year ago, there was a lot of uncertainty about where we were going with trade. And now we have a little more resolution to some of the conflicts that we've been facing. And then I'll focus a little bit on just Washington or Pacific Northwest ag, some of the different commodities that we grow and kind of where we see those going forward. The first thing I want to tell you, though, is this first set of information I'm going to provide you, this broad picture of the ag sector, this is all USDA data. And in about 3 weeks or 2 weeks even, this is all going to be updated. The USDA does what they call the Ag Outlook Forum every February. Secretary speaks at it. The chief economist for USDA comes out and gives us all their new forecasts. They podcast that. They put it out on their website. They publish short videos. So if you're interested in how this information is changing going forward, You can sort of follow that in a couple of weeks as they roll it out. So some of what we're going to talk about is going to be subject to change relatively quickly. First of all, when we look at the ag financial sector, so I have this going back to just before 1980 because that's really where we entered into the last big, what was called the farm financial crisis. If you look at this information, you'll notice that the farm equity position is actually better than it was back in 1980 as we sort of went into that big spiral down for 3 or 4 years. That's a very positive picture. The debt has increased also, the very bottom line, but not to the extent that that the assets have. So we've had growth in equity. That's important because in times of very low prices, when we can't cash flow, it's the equity that we can live off of to sort of maintain the farm and move ourselves forward. The debt increase you see, though, the positive part of that is it's not as high as it was in 1980. This is 2018 dollars, so this is adjusted for inflation. So we've had asset growth that's grown beyond debt service, and so that's a positive thing for agriculture in general. If you look at where the debt is, most of the growth has been in real estate. So we've seen land prices go up significantly over the last 6, 7, or 8 years. Actually, they've been trending higher for quite a while. The non-real estate debt really isn't as high as it was in 1980. So that's also positive because it's real assets that the debt is tied to, land prices for the most part. This is a picture of total farm assets since 1960. So you'll see again, we're well above the 1980 level, and much of it is in the average value of the real estate. So if you go back, this is again is current dollar. So this is adjusted for inflation. So 40 or 50 years ago, land prices on average, just across the whole U.S., so they vary a lot depending on where you are. Illinois, they're much higher than $3,000 an acre for good productive corn soybean ground, for example. In the Palouse, wheat ground is a lot more than $3,000 an acre. But generally, we've gone from $1,000 to almost $3,000 an acre, real growth in value in that farm asset, even with the challenges we've had the last couple of years. Net farm income in 2019, despite the trade frictions, USDA currently forecasts it's going to be higher than sort of the 9 or 10-year average we've had historically. And in fact, it's the first real increase in about 4 or 5 years. So that's very positive. It's not like 2012. Some people yelled out that is the best year of farming in recent history. It's not like that. We don't have the drought that was referred to in the Midwest, which brought us $9 wheat prices at harvest. We don't have anything like that, but what we have had is good production, increases in production capacity, and even with relatively low prices, we've generated higher farm incomes. This is actually a very positive move. And to the extent, and we'll talk about this later, that we get resolution to the trade frictions and a more stable trading environment, this is a trajectory that hopefully we can build on. One of the things that does challenge us is whether or not the current trade environment really has been stabilized and what we see going forward. And number two, especially for crops, relatively high stocks levels globally. And so in some sense, we still face some burdensome supplies as we look out over the global landscape, but there are still positive messages that are coming forward. If you look at receipts, what have we sold this year relative to previous years, you'll notice that things like corn, receipts were up year over year. Soybeans were down. That largely was a trade situation. So it wasn't that prices would have been low in the absence of a trade friction, but because of the way the soybean market trades and who our biggest buyers are, soybean receipts were down. You can see wheat's pretty flat. Vegetables were up. So as we look at that income increase, higher than the last 10-year average, it isn't actually distributed evenly across all commodity sectors. It varies a lot depending on which sector you're operating in. Dairy has done very well this year. The wheat price we're going to get for the marketing year average price, all wheat across all classes across the U.S., will be the lowest price we've had in 2 or 3 years this year. So every sector isn't benefiting the same way, but at least we have general economic growth. This is also a challenge. So what this is showing you is production costs. And I have two things there. Nominal, meaning the dollar that year that you spent, but then also real. That's the top picture. That's adjusted for inflation. And so what we do see is the real cost of production has been increasing, adjusted for inflation. And in fact, it does exceed the cost of production in 1980. And this is per unit produced. So we do have some challenges in terms of how costs are being passed to us relative to how prices are being passed to our customers. In other words, what we're charging versus what we're paying to commodities coming in and going out of our farm. The trade environment has really been challenging. So a year ago, I had that top bullet point. At that time, at least in my opinion, we were sort of entering into the most radical renegotiation in terms of trade alignments we'd had in probably 100 years or maybe a little over 100 years, because we were trying to renegotiate with everybody. If you talk to people now, the big focus is on China because we read about it. USMCA was a big deal for a while. It's finally got ratified. We know about a Japan free trade agreement, not a free trade agreement, a less restricted trade agreement. But we also have conflicts with Turkey. There's conflicts right now going on with the EU. How Britain actually exits the EU could have a lot to do with how we end up trading either with Britain directly or with the EU in general. The realignment of Asian markets and who's negotiating with who. We leave TPP, but the other 11 countries go forward and they negotiate a trade agreement, which gives Canada and Australia potential preference over us going into the Asian markets. The Japan agreement offsets some of that for Japan. Big customer for us for beef and for wheat, really important to us in the Pacific Northwest. But Vietnam really was a growth market, I thought, and they're not part of our new agreement, but they are part of the TPP that Canada and Australia are in. So the whole trade environment a year ago was pretty dicey. The good news now is we have some resolution to some of this. But we have to be careful how we interpret this. USMCA, for most agricultural products, at least in my opinion, my perception, really isn't that different than NAFTA. What it did is get us back on the footing we had before. Now, if you're an upper Midwest dairy producer, it is an improvement because it increases your access to the Canadian market, which was highly restricted before. But if you're a Southwest dairy processor, it actually allows Mexico to increase tariffs on some cheese products beyond what they could have done under NAFTA. So there's varying impacts depending, again, on which sector you're in. For those of us that care about most markets outside of dairy, though, it really does at least give us solid footing, but we're kind of back to where we were. One of the reasons we've seen improvement in the overall trade picture in the last year is because once this was agreed to in late 2018, the three partners started trading as if it was going to be ratified. So, for example, in the fall of 2018, U.S. wheat exports were running about 34% behind where they had been the previous year, 2017, to Mexico, who historically has been our biggest buyer. 2018-19 crop year, they were not our biggest buyer. The Philippines were, because they weren't bringing in the wheat they had before. But once the three presidents agreed, or the prime minister and the two presidents agreed on what this should look like, even before the legislatures ratified it, we started seeing a ratcheting down of trade restrictions, tariffs specifically. And by the end of 2018-19, so May 31st of 2019, the wheat marketing year, we'd exported almost as much wheat to Mexico as we had the previous year, even though we'd been lagging. And that really helped us coming into the current marketing year, the fact that we picked Mexico back up. And in fact, if you look at the wheat U.S. wheat situation, this is the last 3 years. You can see what happened last year. World trade as a result of some of this disruption, and where we are projected to end up May 31st of 2020. And in fact, I'll tell you, I think that May 31st of 2020 bar is too low. And I'll show you this when we talk about wheat specifically, but USDA the last 6 years or so has been overly optimistic early in the marketing year, so the summer and early fall, about how much wheat we were really going to export. And this year, finally, they were overly pessimistic, and I think their number is still too low, so we'll probably see growth in that. But largely, that comes because of a resolution of some of these trade uncertainties going forward. The China agreement, I should have mentioned this when that slide was up, to me, that's just a timeout. It really doesn't improve our trade arrangement. What it does is get rid of the banter about increasing tariffs as we move forward. In fact, with China, their commitment under this phase one agreement is they're going to buy $200 billion worth of stuff from the U.S. Well, in 2017, they bought about $186 or $187 billion. So it's not a huge increase, not insignificant, but not huge. For agriculture, this first year it's supposed to be about $12.5 billion and then $19 billion next year. But in the last 2 years, we spent $28 billion in reparation payments to agriculture for the disruption of trade flow. So in a sense, they're bringing us back to where we were. But here's the problem. They now have a humanitarian crisis that will affect demand for products and supply chain management. The coronavirus is likely to have a huge impact on their ability to either buy from us and then distribute what they do purchase. So even though the commodities they've targeted are wheat, soybeans, pork, those are three of the larger four or five that they've targeted, there will be a challenge to meeting those requirements if, in fact, this health situation deteriorates much further than it already is. There won't be demand, and it disrupts supply chains. Just as an example, one of the ways that manufacturers in the U.S. get intermediate products from China is they come in on passenger aircraft, so in the belly hold of an airplane that has people in it. Well, two major airlines in the U.S. have said, we're not flying to China anymore until this gets resolved. That affects the ability to get these products into the U.S. That affects their income in trade, and it could affect what they end up purchasing. So one of our challenges with China going forward is, one, if they don't meet these expectations, do we assume that they're reneging and we go back to the frictions we had before, or do we assume it's a humanitarian issue and they will meet these targets eventually? And how we manage that will have a lot to do with how the China trade situation affects us in this next couple of crop years. And that will have a lot to do with where wheat actually goes. Here's what's happened to our balance of trade. Look at 2014. That's where it really peaked. That bottom chart is our total sales versus total purchases of agricultural products. Big trade surplus. The reason it started to deteriorate from 2014 forward is the dollar started to get more expensive. The more expensive the dollar is, the more expensive our products are to somebody who's importing them from us. For example, when wheat was $9 at harvest in July and August of 2012, the dollar was actually relatively cheap. So if I'm an importer in Tokyo, I'm a miller, and I come to the U.S. to buy soft white wheat out of Portland, the amount of yen I have to use to convert to dollars is much less than it is if the dollar is expensive, and I can pay a higher U.S. price, and I still come out okay. As the dollar gets more expensive, the price of the commodity that I'm going to try to purchase needs to get cheaper for me to be just as well off and buy as much as I otherwise would have. So we already started to see this problem with our trade surplus going down. Once we entered into battles on trade, though, the first place most of our trading partners targeted was agriculture because they knew that's what would hurt us more than any other sector. So while we generally weren't targeting agriculture products, when we imposed tariffs, the retaliatory tariffs did come against agriculture, and you can see how we bottomed out in 2018. This past year, we finally have another uptick, and part of that is because of the positive impact of USMCA and the perception starting back in October that this Phase 1 China deal would actually happen, and we'd see an uptick in opportunities to trade with China. So for this to continue to move back to where it was before requires two things. The dollar needs to be relatively stable, or at least not appreciate significantly from where it is, and these commitments that have been made in these trade agreements really do need to be followed through on as we go forward. Here's what happened to the U.S. trade balance. So remember, the president took office in January 2017, and he was upset with our balance of trade because he argued that we had been taken advantage of for decades. So he needed to sort of address all of our trading partners and try to resolve that. As we started to impose tariffs, our actually balance of trade went down significantly. In other words, it got worse. And one reason was, as we imposed tariffs against trading partners, and we buy more from them than they buy from us, it ended up driving the U.S. dollar higher. So, because what happens? Well, people importing to us need to buy fewer dollars if they're not going to buy as much product from us, and people we're exporting to don't need to. We don't need to sell them their currency. We don't need to buy their currency. So the dollar ends up ratcheting up relative to the other currencies. And what happened was, we didn't have a positive impact on our trade balance initially because the dollar was making exports more expensive than the U.S. besides just the tariffs, and the expensive dollar, meaning when we converted the dollar to foreign currencies, actually offset much of the tariffs, so it didn't really affect much of what we were purchasing in the short run. If you look at what happened as we went forward, look at that bottom in 2018. I don't have a pointer, but you can see right at 2018 where the bottom was. Trade improved a little bit for a few months, and then it really deteriorated in 2019. We went into the full phase. What has happened now, starting in October or so, is we've started to get back, improve our trade situation as we sort of stabilize the trade environment. We're really kind of back to where we started. So whether or not this trajectory continues and the overall balance of trade is better than it was, if you think a negative balance of trade is bad, better than it was when we started this, will really be a function of the value of the dollar going forward and whether or not all these commitments are made and there's not any retaliation because we or partners believe that one of us isn't performing like we were supposed to under the trade agreement. Right now, we're kind of back to where we were. That's probably positive. This shows the value of the dollar. So what the dollar index is the U.S. dollar tied to six major currencies, both exporters and importers of ours. So the Japanese yen is in there. The euro is in there. Six major currencies associated with our trading partners. The higher that is, the more expensive the dollar is relative to the other foreign currencies. The lower it is, the cheaper the dollar is. A cheap dollar is good for exporters in the U.S., not so good for importers. An expensive dollar is good for importers in the U.S., not so good for exporters. So how this moves affects our balance of trade and whether imports or exports are more or less expensive. Here's what's happened since the initial imposition in 2018 of these trade tariffs. As I said, the dollar reacted. It got significantly stronger, which is why our balance of trade didn't really improve initially, because exports got a lot more expensive. And imports weren't as expensive as they would have been if the dollar had stayed where it was and the tariffs were imposed. It turns out that economies are incredibly complicated. And so when we sort of impose these laser beam policies, thinking we're going to impact one sector or another, it almost never works out that way anymore. Because individual companies are global, how we trade with each other has a huge impact not only on the individual economies in each country, but the movement of goods and services by global companies. As an example, one of the first tariffs we imposed was on steel. Well, U.S. Steel operates in the U.S., but U.S. Steel Europe operates in Europe. One of them does cold-rolled flat steel. One of them does hot-rolled steel. They specialize in those two different markets, and they move intermediate product between the two. So if we have a 25% tariff on European steel, and Europe, and they did, put on a 25% tariff on U.S. steel, what we really did was make it a lot more expensive for U.S. steel to do business because they can't move their intermediate product anymore between their two locations at base price. They're paying tariffs going both directions. That's going to have an impact on both economies, but it's also going to have an impact on that individual company and where they decide to do business. It's much more complicated than it was 100 years ago when we start trying to manipulate trade environments and affecting a single sector or a single firm. At WSU, we put out a publication at the Impact Center there called The Status of Washington Agribusiness. And what we try to do in this publication is we look at the major ag sectors in Washington and forestry. We sort of talk about what's happened in the last year and what do we see happening maybe next year. And then we highlight a couple of research articles, sort of in layman's terms, that are going on at the university that might impact agribusiness. So, for example, this year, one of the major research products that's in this publication is on water use. And what's the trade-off between irrigation in the basin, for example, power generation, and in-stream flow to protect fish populations? How do we think about interacting those things, and what are the trade-offs as we manage one of those water uses at the expense of the other one? Last year, actually, it was all about trade. So last year, what we did is we tried to estimate what the impact was on Washington ag sectors, apples, wheat, other tree fruits, of restricted trade with China, and what was it costing agricultural producers in the short run not to have that trade opportunity. Anyway, you can download this if you want, but what I'm going to talk about now are sort of information that comes out of that publication. So the first thing to notice is how important agriculture is to Washington State. And it's interesting because it varies a lot by where you are. So in the east side of the state, very east, where we are now, wheat production is really important, but on this chart, it's like the third most valuable crop in Washington out of the top five. It does turn out that wheat and dairy can flip-flop, for example. All of these can approach $1 billion. Right now, apples are over $2 billion, dairy's over $1 billion, wheat's under $1 billion. But if you go back to 2012, when wheat prices were very high, wheat was number two, and it was well over $1 billion in activity. But the important thing is this. We have a very diverse agriculture. What happens in certain parts of the states is driven by individual agricultural sectors. So in the basin, potatoes are very important where we irrigate. Out here, dryland wheat's very important. Hops production is very important in Yakima. It really depends on kind of where you are. The other thing to notice is we have one of the most diverse agricultures in the country. So California may be a little more diverse than us. Michigan's pretty close, but we're in the top two or three in terms of the diversity of the products that we distribute. And what that does mean is when we talk about things like that first farm income picture, and income's higher than it's been the last average for the last 10 years, every sector is not benefiting in the same way, and we do have a lot of diversity on how individual policies affect these individual sectors and how they then affect the rural communities where they actually represent the dominant agricultural production. We're number 12 in terms of total revenue. That big bar to the left is California. They're number one. Texas is number two, but then you get down below those two, and it gets pretty flat for a while, and we're kind of in that sort of, I guess I would say, average, even though we're still number 12. Look at the income distribution over the last decade. So a couple of $1 billion increase in total sales. But all that happened between 2008 and 2012, and since then we've been pretty flat. But we're still at almost $9.5 billion in total agricultural sales in Washington, and in my opinion, that's a pretty impressive number.
Impressive, you bet. And unless there is some logistical logjam to gum up the works on account of the coronavirus, then export agriculture in Washington might actually come out of the pandemic looking better than some other industries that had to shut down. Please join me here again next week when Fortenberry continues his presentation in episode 172, focusing on wheat specifically in an episode entitled "The Whys and Wherefores of Wheat Prices." WSU economist Randy Fortenberry sets the scene too, right here on Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.